Hey, welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction. More importantly, it's about recovery. And it's brought to you by our friends at Reprieve Recovery. They're up there in Mountain Green, Morgan, if you will. Dr. Matt, what's been going on with you? Anything good lately?
Yeah, life's good. Went down to Kanab with Ashley and some friends last weekend. First time I've ever been down there. Have you been down there?
I've been to Kanab. I've been down there to where...
Well, you've road tripped the whole state.
Yeah, but there's a hotel that John Wayne used to stay in when he would field the old-time spaghetti westerns.
Okay.
And he always wanted a pool. So he went to the owner of the hotel and said, listen, I will pay half if you pay the other half to get a pool in here. And the guy said, cool. And so he did it, and they call that the John Wayne pool. If you go down there, I don't know if they have it still, but there's an autographed picture of myself hanging up there on the same wall as John Wayne. So
you and John Wayne together.
But they have some ghost towns. They have a lot
We went and saw the – it's like a ghost town. It's the old set for Gunsmoke.
Yeah.
So that we got out. We did some hikes, hung out by the pool a lot. But the one place we did go – on purpose to check out was the Gunsmoke set, because I remember watching Gunsmoke as a kid with my dad, and that was kind of fun. It's mostly fallen down now, but it was fun to walk around.
It's a cool area, and they've also got something, and I don't know if they still do it, but it's a Greyhound dog celebration. Like one time during the year where all these people with Greyhounds come together and celebrate the Greyhound, the majestic beast that it is.
Well, they've got, what's the Best Friends is down there. In
yeah, Best Friends Animal Sanctuary.
Yeah, that's I've a been big there, deal. Yeah.
And that's cool. But this isn't talking about road tripping, although I do love this great state of ours. It's about recovery. And my name is Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. He's a clinical psychologist. Now, Dr. Matt, we're still talking about a little bit of what's going on with my daughter's letter. Currently, it's at 2.6 million views.
That's amazing.
And I'm getting now.
But that's because it touched so many people. I mean, it was such a, you know, an authentic experience for you to open up and share. And so. Again, I'm really glad you did that.
Oh, I'm glad she did that, and I was able to. And like I've said before in previous episodes, I never realized what a gift that letter really is to me and to so many others out there. But I go back and I read some of the comments, and I'm trying to help out where I can and say things and appreciate people taking their time to write me. I'm getting letters from all over the world. I mean, it's crazy. You're going, hey, can you help me out? And I'm like, yeah, I'll do what I can, but I don't live in New York. I don't even know where Albany is, you know. Yeah. But let me see what I can do. And so I'm trying to help out. But I read some of the comments, and it seems like this has been getting more steam. And maybe it's just the trolls on the internet or what, but they're talking about I don't believe it's a disease. And we talked about this before. Mm-hmm. And I don't like to get into that argument because I don't think it does anything, regardless.
Right.
But the fact is, it is a choice for someone to pick up an alcoholic drink, somebody to pick up an opioid, someone to snort cocaine, someone to do whatever their DOC drug of choice is. That first.
It starts as a choice.
Starts as a choice.
Yeah.
And I get that.
Well, but I mean, I'll maybe counter that a little bit, though. How many people do we know from doing this show who were just following, you know, the prescription after a surgery? So is it a choice? Yeah, but I mean, you know, not everybody is doing it recreationally to get started.
Yeah. And the thing that I'm having problem with is that everyone's recovery is different. And through this podcast, we've seen people who've been able to get sober so many different ways, whether they've white knuckled it, they've cold turkeyed it, if you will.
Yeah.
They've went through 12 step. They went through a church program. They went to a rehab. They went to a Buddhist. They went to an Indian.
All different sorts of paths and sometimes multiple paths.
Yeah. Until they found one that worked for them. Okay. For those who say that it's not a choice, that's not a disease, it's a choice. Mm-hmm. Have you ever been gravitated or pulled towards something so bad that you never had control over? Because when you're in active addiction, that's what it is. Your brain is in survival mode, and it's just trying to get its fix to make it feel normal.
Right.
And so, I mean, my ex-wife used to say it all the time, why can't you just quit?
Why can't you quit for me? Why can't you quit for the kids?
And my answer would have been, I've tried, but I didn't, because I didn't want to admit that I had no control over this.
I would challenge people to think of it this way. whatever you believe a disease happens to be, think about the basic facts of a disease. A disease is a change in your biological system that sort of takes over its normal functioning and changes how your body functions for the worse, not the better. Right. Mm-hmm. And we would say, well, that's a disease. And we work hard to find cures and treatments for diseases. I don't see that being any different than what happens in addiction. Your brain chemistry changes. Your body changes. It starts to go through symptoms of withdrawal. It changes for the worse. It is moving towards trying to get you to feed the disease by active addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And in that same process, I don't really believe that there is a significant difference between what somebody might say is addiction and what is disease. It is the disease model fits an addiction. And
it's qualified as a disease. Just to be 100% honest.
Just so you know, it is considered a disease by the medical community.
Yeah.
And it fits that disease model. And we go about trying to find treatments for it in a similar fashion. And it does destroy your brain and your body over time, just like any other disease would. So I think that's more of a defensive, the person who really holds on to that belief that it's not a disease, that it's just purely a choice, I would say, A, most likely has never experienced it themselves,
mm-hmm.
and B, has had some trauma in their family or close friends growing up that has led them to be angry about it. And that anger is making the person feel like that it's not a disease.
That's why I don't like to get into that argument with people, is because of that right there, what you just said, is that we're not fighting about the person or the disease. We're fighting about what's going on with them. And then it's not going to be about what the actual disease and the addiction is. The thing you said is that it's a biological change. Mm-hmm. And I agree with that 100%. I can tell you from experience that I had a biological change.
Sure.
So we've got to figure out how to change that back, how to stop that, and how to move forward. So that's what I want to focus my energy on, is how to get them right. Let's not argue how they got there. Let's argue on how to get them out of there.
Right. And I think, you know, 2 years ago when we started this show, we made a conscious decision to focus on recovery. We named the show Project Recovery. We wanted to focus on stories of recovery and treatment modalities and things like that. Because that's the most important place to focus for us.
Mm-hmm.
How it starts, if you want to get in and debate the nitty-gritty biological details, most of us aren't qualified to even understand that.
I'm not.
And so I think what I would encourage the public to do is embrace what the medical community knows, and that is a substance abuse and addiction is a disease. And it affects people in many different ways, but we know it does not discriminate. It doesn't matter who you are in this world. You are susceptible to it, possibly. And I would encourage everyone to focus on the recovery aspect, you know, what we do here on the show. Can we find resources and monies and support for people that helps them get over this disease of addiction? And that saves lives. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. You and I have both had tearful moments over the last couple of years, seeing the beauty in a person's story of recovery and how wonderful their life is, and how one person, the ripple effects of their sobriety positively affects so many people. You know, it ripples out like on a pond.
Pebbles in a pond. I get it. And, you know, you said something that's going to really lead us into our guest today. Addiction does not discriminate. Our guest today is a former BYU professor.
Brigham Young University.
That's right. Your alma mater. And we're going to talk to him and find out how addiction started with him and what he's doing now. You're listening to Project Recovery right here. Hey, welcome back to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction. More importantly, it's about recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt Woolley. He's a clinical psychologist. You're an owner of a PhD, aren't you?
I have one, yeah.
Well, now we've got two PhDs in the room. Our guest today is Matthew Jackson. He was a former professor at BYU. Before we got started, Matthew, I said, hey, do you go by Matt or Matthew? You said something interesting. You said, since my recovery, I've been going by Matthew. Is there a certain reason why?
I don't know. Maybe a sense of renewal. My mother called me Matthew. what better reason do you need?
Well, no, because I think sometimes when we're in recovery, we are kind of reinventing ourselves.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think maybe subconsciously that was a reason why, or maybe you just wanted a new start. But I found that interesting.
Well, it's transformative, right? I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, our name is very personal. And when we've had a major transformation in our life, sometimes it feels good. It's not uncommon for a person to kind of go by a different version of their name. As kind of a way of connecting with their new self.
Now, I don't want to steal Matt's thunder, Dr. Matt, that is, because normally he goes, we like to find a little bit about our guest before we get into the story. So, Matthew, where does your story begin?
Oh, so I was actually born not far from here over in Rose Park and lived there until I was about six. We moved to Arizona, Tempe, for a couple of years, but I call Ephraim home. I grew up down in San Pete County. I'm the third oldest of 10 children.
Wow.
I always get so wow, even in Utah.
Tens a bunch. Yeah. That's two basketball teams.
It's. I mean, we had, you know, our own little Mormon pioneer experiment going on down there.
So you're of the LDS faith?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I grew up in the church. And unlike a lot of stories you hear on here, a very good, healthy family. My father's a psychologist, actually. My mother had a degree in family science, I believe.
That's a lot of psychology going on in the household.
I grew up on cognitive behavioral therapy.
Two shrinks, yeah.
So,
but your early years, no addiction, no alcohol, nothing, just kind of.
Well, okay, so here's where my addiction story starts. When I was about, I would guess, 10, 11, not uncommon at that time, in our medicine cupboard, we had a bottle of paregoric syrup, which is anhydrous morphine, I believe. And it was used as sort of a cure-all for diarrhea, upset stomach. I don't know if you've heard of that before, but
That's a new one on me.
A licorice flavor to it. It's kind of.
We just had the Pepto.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, my family, it was whiskey.
Really?
Yeah. I mean.
Give you a whiskey if you had an upset stomach?
Yeah, just a little shot of whiskey.
Wow. Okay.
Well, this was. Anyway, I remember my reaction to taking that.
So it has alcohol in it.
It does have some alcohol in it, but it's the morphine in it.
It's the morphine, yeah.
Okay. Paregoric syrup.
Paregoric. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. It's actually from the Greek word soothing and comfortable words.
Okay.
And it was. It made me feel great. And so I remember this was my first instance of self-medicating. I would go to the cupboard and just take a pull on it. And that was it for a while.
But you had a lot of siblings you could blame that on.
I was never asked about it, so I don't know. It was, but yeah, I mean, that stands out as the first incident, I guess, of feeling something from a substance like that and yeah, no other issues, problems. I mean, I've got a great group of friends. We're involved in all kinds of activities. I'm involved in sports. And I guess you could say I was part of a, you know, popular crowd, whatever. And I've thought about this a lot. I don't know if it was out of boredom or curiosity, maybe a little rebellion. Maybe just wanting a little more excitement out of life than typical small town Mormon. I don't know, but I found it was four cans of a 6-pack of, Schlitz beer under a culvert in a gutter, appropriately enough. And I remember finding it and then going back that night. This was across the street from our house, and there's a big field for the elementary school and the junior high school there in Ephraim, and drinking those beers.
How old were you at that time?
It was the summer of my 16th birthday, so just before my junior year in high school. And, you know, and I don't remember getting the same kind of reaction.
The syrup.
But it felt good. And I had a couple of friends that started drinking. And so we were drinking on the weekends, you know, sort of a casual thing and partying and, you know, going to high school dances, drunk and whatever. But that was soon followed by introduction of marijuana. And that kind of became the pattern increasingly in my junior year, and then amplified that next summer, where it was almost a nightly thing, a daily thing. We were out drinking and getting high. A kid moved in from California to high school, and he and I, you know, have you go into a room of 100 people, and you can find the other addict in the room,
mm-hmm.
right? And so we sort of found each other, and I mean, yeah, we were high every day before school, lunchtime, after school, and that continued for quite a while.
Let me ask you a question. During that time in San Pete, a small town in Utah, were you the only two doing this, or do you think it was more prevalent?
Oh, it was pretty prevalent. I don't know. I mean, San Pete did have, I don't know, I'm sure it probably still does have, a high percentage per capita of alcoholics. I can tell you this, we never really had. I remember one time having a hard time finding weed and driving to Springville or somewhere, Salt Lake, one day out of, you know, 4 years that I couldn't find weed.
Okay. So it's pretty accessible.
Yeah. And we could get alcohol pretty much whenever we wanted.
Do you feel like you were addicted then, or was it just what everybody was doing?
It started out as what everyone was doing.
But you guys were doing it more?
Oh, daily, yeah. And quickly became an addiction. I remember, and you think you're hiding everything really well. My parents confronted me, did a little intervention, and asked me if I wanted help. And of course, I'm like, help with what? And it turns out, you know, there was a list going around town of suspected drug dealers, and I was on it. But
I was going to ask what your reputation had become by the time you were a senior in high school, because having grown up in a small town myself, I know that it doesn't take long before the rumors, you know, get widespread and everybody knows who's doing what.
Bad gas travels fast in a small town.
Yeah, I mean, me and this kid and a few others. We had earned that reputation. So it wasn't a secret, but this was about, this must have been the end of my senior year. So I still had a couple more years to go, but they asked if I wanted help. And once, you know, I understood that they knew what I was doing, I was like, sure, I guess. So I actually went into treatment before treatment centers were really popular at Utah Valley Hospital. And for insurance to pay for it, I went into the mental health ward, psych ward, and stayed there for 21 days to detox. I remember we did some CBT stuff, you know, look at the positive in life kind of stuff. And I relapsed a couple of days after I got out, not surprisingly, and started to, of course, intensify drug use and the kinds of drugs.
What, just for the listeners, what year?
So this would be
are we talking?
So this would be 80 through 84.
Okay. So in those years, yeah, the popularity and the options for treatment hadn't really become what they are yet today by any means, right?
Yeah, no.
And a lot of people wouldn't want to go do what you did because you'd be on a psychiatric ward with people that were, you know, struggling with serious mental illness, not just the depressed and the anxious among us, but schizophrenic and bipolar folks and people who weren't well treated medication wise. So what was that like as a young kid?
Being
on a psychiatric ward with folks like that.
You think about it now, the stigma that addiction carries. Back in 1980 to 84, in a small town, you go away for 21 days. You want to talk about gossip traveling. I mean, that probably was a lot to bear when you got back.
You know, I don't remember it being, but again, I was off and running again. But it's interesting that you said, you know, depression and anxiety, because in hindsight, it would have been appropriate for me to be there because it's part of what I was struggling with and covering up with the addiction, right? And then along with that, in a small town and in a predominantly Mormon community, the shame and guilt that come along with that, that just adds to the emotional pain that then needs to be numbed with drugs and alcohol.
Did you run up against, because it's still prevalent today, although I think much less so, the religious pressure to, well, if you just prayed more, if you're more faithful, you're not going to struggle with these problems. I still have people come in and talk about crises of faith because they feel like they're not faithful enough and they still have anxiety or they still have depression. Was that part of what was talked about?
Not so much then. That came later. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
So this buddy and I got a job. I'd been working construction, and we worked at a golf course together, and it was ideal. We'd go out there and party all night and water the golf course and then get up and golf and go to the lake. And I heard you guys talk about this before on the podcast. Those days were fun. We were having a blast, you know, just doing whatever we wanted, going to parties, a lot of keggers and stuff. But there are a couple of things that happened. In my senior year, and I think this is important to talk about, even though it's a bit difficult, I got to a place that the Big Book calls the jumping off place, which is that realization that you can't live with the drugs and alcohol, but you also can't live without it. And I remember sitting in the truck with a rifle and having suicidal thoughts for the first time. I just wanted to escape. I was stuck and knew I was in trouble. I didn't like what I was doing, but I couldn't see any way out of it. And there was, you know, I didn't know anyone I could go talk to about any of that. Anyway, so obviously,
I mean, that's a real catch-22 when a person gets to that point, right? Because just like you said, you feel completely stuck. I know I can't live without this stuff, but at the same time, it's destroying me. I see what it's doing to my life. And when a person has that moment of realization, it's not uncommon to think of the most extreme solution you can, which is escaping this life. Well, if I'm not here, that seems like the only solution.
You know, in the 2 years that we've been doing this podcast, I've never heard somebody put it like that. And which is crazy because we've had so many people come in who talk about the Big Book and the 12 steps. But what you just described is what so many addicts are going through. I know so many people who go, this is BS because you're the addict and we're paying for it. And I go to that person, I go, hey, the addict's not having fun.
No.
You know what I mean? When you think they're partying, they're not partying. They're just trying to get normal. They're just trying to level the playing ground so they can walk around with everybody else. Right. So the way you put that, say it one more time.
Well, the Big Book calls it the jumping off place. It's just a place where you realize you can't live with your addiction and you can't live without it. And it's a hopeless, desperate feeling.
And that led you to sitting in a truck with a rifle.
Contemplating suicide, yeah. And we'll come back to another incident here later on that's similar. But I got past that this buddy and I got jobs doing seismograph work. I don't want to go off too much on this, but it's doing oil exploration work. You fly around in helicopters, hike out and up and down mountains out in the desert, laying cable. My buddy was on the drill rig, and he would drill down, put dynamite down in there, charge. We'd go out and lay phones down. It would go back to a computer and the seismograph report and
earthquakes and stuff and all that,
We were called juggies. And if you know anything about that culture, juggies are druggies. And so I got introduced to a job where I could use drugs all day long, all night long, and got more and better drugs. So I got involved with psychedelics and cocaine and a bunch of other stuff. But it was just, we'd go to work, and it was hard work, and we'd go to the bar afterwards. I worked that job for about a year and had another incident where I had this old Willie's Jeep, this candy apple red Jeep with a Chevy 357 engine in it. And I'm driving from Ephraim to Manti. I'm on break from work and just going to check out the parties or whatever. And bent down to, I took my eye off the road for a second to change the radio station or something. Look up, and there are these Charley bulls in the road. And I'm going 70 miles an hour. Hit them, flip and roll. Don't have a seatbelt on. I'm drunk and stoned. And somehow walk away from that. And
wow.
I remember my mother saying something to the effect of, well, God must want you alive still. And I'm like, well, maybe, I don't know about that. All I know is I got some Percocet for my neck, and I was down for a couple of weeks, and then I was back out. But it did get me thinking, I think, a little bit about some things and life changes. Anyway, that continues. I go back. I went to Snow College. And, you know, I mean, I was drinking in the library and not really. I would go to class, but I wasn't really into college at that point. But I remember we went down to, with a backpacking group, to Havasupai Falls. Beautiful hike down there. And I had been trying to quit drinking and smoking pot, and had even thought about going on a mission. At this point, I'm 20 years old, and had pretty much quit some things, but was still struggling. You know, I'd quit for, you know how it goes. You quit for a few days or a week, and then you go back. But I went on this backpacking trip and didn't take anything with me, and was feeling pretty good about getting clean. And then, of course, some other guys had some pot down there, and I smoked with them. And that night, I had a spiritual awakening. We call it a God shot, I guess. But I had this dream, I don't know, of being up on a high cliff, and it was, the wind was blowing, and I remember my life being in danger, and knowing that if I didn't change something, I was going to be dead. That was the feeling I got. Anyway, it was enough of a spiritual experience to propel me into full recovery. And I would say, in hindsight, I really worked the 12 steps without knowing what the steps were. Did the work to go on a mission. So I was missionary at 21. I went to Ecuador and came back. And I was clean and sober for 20 years. Got married in the temple. I finished no college. Only took me 3 years to complete a two-year education. and then went to BYU and was doing the thing there. I started out as a psych major, shifted into English. Did my BA and MA there in English. Got married in 91. And now have 5 kids. And things were going really well. I mean, I was working hard. Active member of the church. And then...
At this point, were you teaching at BYU now also?
I had started teaching part-time, mm-hmm. Just as a graduate student in 93, or 91, actually. But also worked, so after my master's, I had applied to some PhD programs sort of half-heartedly because I didn't know what else to do. I was going to, like, accept me into your PhD program because I don't know what else to do with my life. And I worked at a software company doing some technical writing training, and then I became, this will make me seem really old, I became their first webmaster, content webmaster, when the internet was brand new.
The dial-up years.
So this is when companies were still deciding whether or not to even have a web page, you know, and we're creating a web page from scratch. This guy I worked with was the technical web guy.
I'm going to stop you there just for a second, because your first part of your story is an amazing story, an amazing journey, and proof that recovery is possible. And you kind of told that first part of your story little flippant, a little lighthearted, you know, mm-hmm. what I mean? And you could tell that you were kind of having fun with it, you know what I mean? And kind of your origin story. But when it came to you getting married and we're getting ready to go into the second part of your addiction, you kind of changed. I mean, you could tell that there was a seriousness and there was a visible change in your mannerisms and your speech and kind of the way you were talking. Explain that to me a little bit.
Oh, things get a lot less fun from here on out. I mean, at that point, I knew I was in real trouble the last couple of years of my addiction. You know, and like you said, you're still trying to get the party started again, like it was when you first started partying. And it never happens. And then you're just trying to maintain and stay functioning. But I got to a point where I was at peace with all of that relatively quickly because I had changed my life. I was doing great. I was doing good things. And everything was, you know, on the up and up and onward and upward from there on out. And things went that way.
20 years.
The problem really in hindsight started probably about 10 years after my marriage where I started because I was doing so well. And this is such a gradual thing that you become to believe in your own power. You're in control of everything. I was smart. I was athletic. I could do pretty much what I set my mind to. And that's great. I mean, we should be that way to some extent. And what I found was that I got a lot of mileage out of doing good things and doing more. And this is where really my next phase of addiction starts, is with high caffeine level ephedra energy drinks. And this was 20 years ago or more, because I found that when I was tired, I could drink those, and these have like 330 milligrams of caffeine, and I don't know how much ephedra in them, which they don't put ephedra in them anymore, but I could just get more good stuff done, right? And so I'm working full-time at the software company. I'm teaching part-time. I'm helping raise kids. I'm remodeling a house in Springville, recreating. You know, I've always been very active, especially outdoors, cross country, or telemark skiing and mountain biking, trail running, whatever.
You didn't have time to sleep.
Well, the sleep deprivation didn't start until I started my PhD program. So I have this great job. I'm making good money, and I hate it. I go to the same building every day, and I worked with fun people. It was a good job. It just wasn't satisfying. It wasn't rewarding for me. That's when I was like, oh, yeah, I really wanted to be a teacher. Because I loved teaching that part-time teaching gig and had continued to do that. So I applied to a PhD program at the U, and my intention was to get accepted into their education program because their English program was so hard to get into, and then transfer over to English. I loved the first class I took was an education, philosophy of education course, and I loved it. And really enjoyed graduate school. And if I were independently wealthy, I'd go back to school and get another degree.
I am so with you on that.
It's great.
You and I maybe are the only people that feel that way. There's a few others, but every time I say that to someone, they look at me like I'm crazy. But wasn't it awesome?
Wasn't it great?
Yeah, if you didn't have to worry about all the other things in life and you could just go to school.
Yeah. So, I did have a lot of other stuff to worry about. At this point, we had my two daughters, I have five children, two girls and three boys. And I'm commuting 3 to 5 times a week up to the U, doing all the other stuff I'm doing. And the thing that goes is sleep. And I find that through these energy drinks, of course, I can make it happen. But then I'm drinking, you know, consuming like 1,000, 1,200 milligrams of caffeine a day. And that starts to take a toll. And the other thing that I am on is Furanol, which is a medication they gave early on for migraines. I had my first migraine in high school. Just knocked me flat out of nowhere. And I got them occasionally. Didn't really start to get them until after I was married and things become more stressful and... But the Furanol has aspirin, caffeine, and butylbital, which is a barbiturate in it. So I'd taken this barbiturate 3 times a day for about 30 years. So that kind of balanced me out a little bit with the energy drinks. So that goes on. And meanwhile, I mean, from the time I was young, I'd periodically gotten pain medication from dentists and doctors. And that's when I began seeking out, you know, I'd have a sore shoulder, sore knees or whatever, and go into doctor's offices and get prescriptions for pain pills. And again, what I found was I can do more good stuff on the energy drinks and the combination of the pills that I'm taking. So that, of course, starts to escalate. But I get a lot of mileage out of doing lots of good things.
And you're probably getting a lot of positive feedback. People are probably like, wow, look at all you're doing. And, you know, neighbors and friends and family being really impressed. Because, I mean, I'm sitting here listening to your story, and I'm like, man, this guy's working a full-time job. He's teaching. He's going to school. He's doing the family stuff. I mean, look at all that you're accomplishing. I'm sure you were getting a lot of positive feedback.
Yeah. And I loved it. I mean, I think part of that was really driven by my own, in hindsight, you know, in a big book, talk about self-centered fear being, you know, the primary driving factor of our addiction. I think because I had such a strong felt need to be accepted, and, you know, you become afraid of failure, and the drive to accomplish things and become, especially we were talking about this earlier, but in Western society, for men to attain, you know, a profession that's admirable and you can make a good living at and provide for your family. So I was driven by some really good things, but I was also driven by a lot of really unhealthy psychological things and emotional things that I've just started to really understand in retrospect.
And the fuel you were using wasn't good. I mean, it was caffeine, barbiturates, and that was your fuel.
Right. And then the opioids come in, and then I can do even more because I'm not feeling any physical or emotional pain.
We haven't talked much about your wife during this. I mean, did she know any of this, or was she kind of...
yeah. Well, yes and no. I mean, I was a very functional addict for a very long time. And again, because I was doing so well in so many areas, I was able to hide a lot of that for a long time. At some point, and I don't know, I'd have to ask her exactly when she became aware, but, you know, she'd see me taking pills here and there, or she'd see them. And then eventually, because addiction is a progressive disease, it became more manifest as things sort of started falling apart. So I'll come back to that a little bit more. But so I'm working with these substances and this level of addiction, but still being able to maintain some professionalism, accomplish what I want to, keep my good standing in the church, because it's all technically okay. and of course, I'm lying the whole time, but you don't want to admit that you're, you know, a liar. I can now, but the self-deception that comes in, the delusion that your life becomes, because addiction is such a disease of perception, that I think I'm okay and I'm in control and I've got a plan for everything, right? It's all going to work out. So I get to the point where I'm finishing my PhD and I get hired at BYU, which is huge. I mean, this was what I wanted to do, was become a professor. And I loved being a professor. But I'm under this tremendous pressure, most of it self-imposed, to do all these things. So I get hired before I finish writing my dissertation. And you know that's not a good thing. Because a lot of people would say, don't do anything but your degree. And then when you get your degree, take a year off before you get hired to sort of recuperate. And then you can go into it.
That would be ideal, but I don't know.
I don't know how often it happens. But I remember hearing that and I'm like, wouldn't that be nice? But I remember thinking at that point that it would really be good to just escape somewhere, go up to a cabin in the mountains for a month and just decompress. Like, I was exhausted at this point, sleep deprived and just running on too much, running faster than I had strength. So I've got the pressure to not only take on the new responsibilities of being a professor, but also to finish my PhD in order to keep my job, because if I don't finish it by December 31st, I lose my contract. So I go to my family doctor and tell him about, you know, and I've got pain in my neck. Turns out I have a really horrible spine anyway. And I can't sleep, and I, you know, I'm tense, and my muscles all hurt. And so he prescribes me the Holy Trinity. This is where I get introduced to the Holy Trinity. I don't know if you know that term.
I don't.
It's a pain med and a benzodiazepine and a muscle relaxant, specifically Lortab, Xanax, and Soma.
Wow.
Yeah, they don't do that anymore.
No, they don't.
And not just a little bit. It's like three a day of each.
Oh my.
For a month.
Wow.
And I start off being pretty careful. I take a half of a Lortab when I need it. And it helps. I'm able to concentrate. I can write, finish my dissertation. I remember the first time I took the Xanax, and I thought, I'll take one and just lie down for a minute. And I slept more soundly for a couple hours than I had in years. And I was like, holy shit, this is good stuff. And I, of course, it didn't take long. I was back in his office for more, and that really was when my addiction took off. Because I didn't have any, I didn't have a need to stop doing all of the good stuff I was doing, and these medications just allowed me to do more for a little while. Then I haven't heard anybody talk about this on your podcast, which is surprising because it was so easy. I mean, it took a lot of effort, but there was a loophole at some point in how online doctors and online pharmacies could prescribe medication in the, it would have been the late 90s, or well, I guess it would have been, so I got hired at BYU in 2005. So it would have been in the mid 2000s. So, and we had some money. I had enough that I could take my MRI, which I'd gone to get treatment for my migraines. And I had the MRI of my spine, which showed some problems. I don't even think they cared. I would send that in with the needed money, and they would send me the same three or four medications. They'd send me Lortab, Xanax, Soma, and Fiorinol. And I was doing this with my family doctor and then two or three other online pharmacies at the same time.
You know, I don't think we have had anybody talk about the online pharmacy situation from that time period, because it was difficult to regulate. It's better now, of course. But, yeah, I think you might be the first person who's come on and talked about how you could run that scam, basically, between, you know, your in-person family doctor and then take the same thing online.
So you were getting four times.
I had buckets of pills. I had a secret UPS box that I would have the pills sent to. And yeah.
Was that to hide it from your wife?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And at this point, yeah, she's becoming aware of what's really going on.
You said this is when the addiction really took off. So how long did you, roll with the Holy Trinity, if you will.
As long as they let me. I mean, this, you have to remember, this is when Purdue Pharma is coming out and saying, these aren't addictive. It's all good. And doctors were like, we don't want you to be in any pain. So here you go. And I, you know, they can take some of the responsibility. But that's on me. You know, I've got to take responsibility for some really bad choices early on there.
I agree with that. But I also, I mean, we trust what professionals tell us. And I think that goes back to like the people who sponsor our show, trying to encourage people nowadays to really speak up.
I wish they'd have been around.
Right. Because back, I mean, I think that's our natural tendency. You have an expertise I have an expertise. So if somebody comes and asks us a question, they tend to trust us. And you and I do the same when we go to our doctors, or if I have friends who are attorneys, if I have legal questions, I trust what they say. And I think that's true and has gotten, at least it's been an easy excuse to hold on to for a lot of people who struggle with addiction, because if the pharmacy says, oh, this is fine, or the doctor says this is fine, then we trust it.
Right. Well, I think that went both ways. I think I was able to maintain that level of addiction, especially with whether it was my family doctor when I finally switched to other doctors, or I went to a pain clinic eventually. Because I was well educated and had money and was a respectable person, I wasn't coming in, jonesing and grubby licking off the streets. I was given the benefit of the doubt. He must be okay with this, and so we'll prescribe it for him. And it fed into my own delusion that, yeah, I'm in control of all this. I'm not an addict. I'm not an addict or alcoholic like those people.
Oh, I've said those words.
Right? I lived that life for a long time.
So you roll with the Holy Trinity for as long as you can.
Yeah.
But eventually, you says it starts to take its toll. What does that look like?
I think my mother maybe noticed physically what was happening before anyone, and she had some experience with that with a couple of other children, a couple of my siblings. But she was, I believe, in charge of instigating a little trip to the Pavilion out in Payson Hospital, if you remember. It was called a treatment center. It wasn't really a treatment center. I don't know that it's there anymore, but this would have been a couple, 3 years into my, after my hire at BYU. So 2008, I think. And, I'm still on the energy drinks and I'm just amped up all the time. And she drove me out there and I was there for 10 days. I mean, it was a detox. I don't think we ever had any real therapy sessions.
It seems back like then, groups, that's what we thought. We said, if we can just get it out of your system, you'll know not to do it again.
Yeah,
I was told. Understand the underlying issues of what's going on. But back then, that was the reset. That was the control, alt, delete back there. Seven to 10 days, get it out of your system. We know you're not going to go back there again because, look how painful that was to detox.
Right.
They don't understand the addict brain. It's like, man.
That was painful. I mean, I was just, I wanted to die. I mean, you know what detox is like. Coming off of that much caffeine alone was horrible, but that much of an opioid and everything else I was on.
Were you having caffeine-induced panic attacks? Because a lot of my patients who drink that much caffeine, they can start themselves down a road of these caffeine-induced panic attacks.
Hang on. So I make it. I don't know. I just wanted to die. I couldn't even get out of bed the first 3 days. And thankfully, a nurse there, she probably saved my life, got me to come down the hall and drink a cup of broth and the salt and liquid to keep me alive for a couple more days. But, I couldn't even open my eyes or read. So I spend the 10 days there and get out and, everybody thinks everything's going to be fine. You said, it's out of your system, technically, not understanding anything about addiction. And I relapse later that day because I'm a pill stasher. So I got pills all over. It just continues. And I don't know if it was caffeine induced, but if you've never had a real panic attack, it's hard to understand. But I remember being, and this is when I'm on all these medications. I'm on enough benzos that I shouldn't be having a panic attack. But I remember lying on the floor of my office at BYU thinking I'm going to die from this panic. I can't even get up off the floor to dial 911. And I'm in, you know, curled up in the fetal position, just thinking I'm going to die.
Well, it takes over your body. I have a good friend who's like spent 20 years as an ER physician, and he said that in some extreme cases, it even takes a veteran like him a few minutes to figure out it's not a heart attack.
Yeah.
When a person has a severe panic attack because of the chest pain and the shaking and the dizziness and all the same symptoms of a heart attack. So, yeah, I think that when a person has a true severe panic attack, you're incapacitated.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was terrifying.
So you don't die on the floor of BYU?
No. But I know I'm in real trouble. But again, this is where, and we talked a little bit about this, but, and I don't want to get too far off on this. It's a good example of the argument of whether addiction is a choice or a disease. At this point, I can see this is affecting everything in my life that I care about. I've been through the detox. I know how horrible that pain is, but yet I continue in my addiction because I need that to survive. And you know, some people might say, well, you're choosing to do that. It's not the same thing as someone who's clean and sober making a rational, reasonable decision or choice. It's not the same thing. Addiction is a disease of choice. Anyway, so I continue with that. And yeah, at this point, my ex knows that I'm in trouble. And I end up losing a job. I went up for my third year review. And I had good teaching scores. I published 5 peer-reviewed articles. But I went up in 2009 when the recession hit. And I don't know why I lost the job. If it was because of the recession or because people knew what was going on or God didn't want me teaching at BYU anymore. I don't know. Pick your reason.
But for whatever reason, you didn't get renewed.
Right. And this is devastating to me because this was my dream job. Now, had I been healthy and clean and sober, I had connections across the nation. I'd been presenting papers at conferences nationwide a couple times a year. And knew people at different universities and could have gone to a different university. Also had another factor where we decided to stay in Provo. I have a son who has a medical issue, and we found him some help that was what he needed in Provo at the time. So we decided to stay. And I became one of, you know, innumerable people with graduate degrees looking for a job along the Wasatch Front. There's a huge number of overeducated people along the Wasatch Front looking for jobs. I mean, you can look at the adjunct faculty at UVU as an example, right? Mm-hmm. Which I did teach at UVU part-time and loved it there. But looking for a job, really depressed. My addiction's still going strong. Things are really starting to fall apart on the home front. And I just slide deeper and deeper into the depths of my addiction. And at this point, I had gone to... So let me back up just a little bit. When I was in the pavilion, my sister, who's a recovering addict, she brought me the big book. And was like, you need to work these steps. And I looked over the steps and was like, I already understand all of that.
While you were doing all this, was alcohol ever hanging with you?
At that point, no, because see, you said earlier that you drank alcohol because it was legal.
Yeah.
I didn't use alcohol during this time because it was against the word of wisdom. Now hang with me here. This is so.
Which is why a lot of people in Utah who are active members of the LDS Church get caught up in prescription drug abuse,
right?
Because it's not technically against the church's health code.
A doctor prescribed it.
Right.
And a lot of church leaders say, if your doctor says it's okay and you need it, I'm taking that at its word.
I mean, we're splitting hairs, oh. but I understand. Yeah.
Not even splitting hairs. It's because, just full-on denial and delusion.
Yeah.
But.
So she brings you a 12-step book and the big book, and you're in there for not alcohol.
Well, yeah, I'm like, first of all, I'm not an alcoholic, and even if I am an addict, I'm not that kind of addict, you know?
Yeah.
And as like most addicts, I think my case is different.
I'm
unique.
Special.
I'm special. I'm above all this.
I got a PhD.
I'm smart. I can figure this out. Because that had worked for me up to that point. If I work hard and apply myself, my willpower and my intellect will save me. And I've got a plan. I can make this work. And I don't remember her saying this at the time. She said this later when I was an inpatient. that there, no one is too dumb to work the steps. There are plenty of people who are too smart to work the 12 steps.
I like that.
Yeah. Oh, she's been a real inspiration in my recovery. So yeah, I don't think I need any of that. But I did agree to go to the LDS Church's ARP meetings.
That's their version of the 12 step.
Right. And it's a beautiful manual. I go to those Zoom meetings now. I've worked that workbook. I find them really helpful. I understand why some people don't. They're very different than other NA and
AA it's meetings. Evident who your God is and what your spiritual program is. I mean, and I think that's where the people have problem with it. And yeah. I mean, I understand it, but I think for those who are in the LDS community and the faith, it's a good program.
Yeah. Well, and I can say more about that in a minute maybe, but, so at this point I'm having a hard time maintaining the ability to get the drugs that I want. You know, doctors are becoming more wise to that kind of addiction. So this is in, you know, 2011, 12, 13. And so I'm doctor shopping. I've been at the pain clinic for a while, and they're still prescribing me. For a while, they prescribed the Holy Trinity. Then they stopped doing the benzos. And then eventually they stopped prescribing Soma, which I don't, I loved Soma, but I hear it's not a good medication. I don't know. So, boy, I mentioned that I had really been into outdoor activities. I wouldn't say extreme sports, but I did some body punishing stuff outside for a long time, for years and years. I'd been training for a triathlon, but I'd also had a few accidents that were spinal impact accidents. I had one when I was just after high school, a construction accident that dropped a big weight on my right on top of my head, and then the Jeep accident and some other things that I end up with a bunch of spine problems. And I remember getting on my mountain bike, and this would have been after I'd lost the job at BYU. In the springtime, I'd always gone to mountain biking to get into really good shape because it didn't seem like exercise. I loved to mountain bike. And I got about a block and a half, and my lower back hurt so bad, I had to get off the bike and walk. And it turns out that my sciatic nerve was being impinged on, and they did another MRI, and I've got all kinds of problems with my back. And I had been doing yoga for years and all this exercise, and it was a bit of a shock to me to have that happen. And eventually, I ended up getting back surgery, spinal fusion on my L5-S1, which some people would say, you know, shouldn't have done the surgery. And you should know that if you're considering spine surgery, there's just as good a chance that it will make it worse as make it better, and it may just stay the same. And that's held pretty true from people I've talked to, but it helped me. It got rid of the sciatic nerve pain. I mean, I got to the point where I used to love to golf, and I'd walk about 3 or 4 or 5 holes, and I could barely stand up anymore because the sciatic nerve pain was so bad. It was just this... felt like, you know, my left leg was on fire. And the surgery helped, but it also gave me a reason to always have pain pills. So at this point, I guess the year before my back surgery, I got a job teaching high school in Wendover. And this is a... it's hard for me to know how to make amends for teaching...
Under the influence?
That many years, yeah. I mean, I wasn't a bad teacher, and a lot of times I was a good teacher. But to not have... It's impossible for me not to have regrets about that. Especially when I start teaching high school. I knew a lot about public education. I'd read about it. I'd studied it in my PhD in education, right? But it's very different from actually going and teaching high school. And so I'm driving out to Wendover, staying out there during the week, and my ex is talking about, we're separated at this point. We've been separated a couple years. And then I would drive back on the weekends and spend time with my kids. My ex has always been very, very good about having me in my kids' lives, which is has been an incredible blessing. But at this point, I start smoking again because I can't stay awake. And I love to smoke. Nicotine is one of my favorite things. These are a few of my favorite things. But I also, again, get really depressed and I'm on all kinds of pain medication. At this point, my pain clinic had given me the short-acting Oxycontin and the long-acting oxycodone. So I'm prescribed way more pain medication than anyone ever needs, I think. And I can barely function on that much pain medication, but it's still not enough to numb out the pain that I feel. So I start smoking pot again, start drinking again, and that's when the alcohol comes back into the picture. And I'm pretty much done with everything. Teaching does keep me going. I love teaching. And I'd go put in what I thought was a good effort there. But as soon as I was done, I was back in my little room out there in Wendover and just getting wasted because I can't bear to live my life sober at this point. And I'd come back on the weekends and kind of fake it. But I think that's about the time my ex decided that I was doing more damage than and didn't see me being willing to get out of any of that and made the decision to start divorce proceedings. So we ended up getting divorced later that year. But yeah, it was, so I got the back surgery and at that point, it seems like doctors in Utah Valley became, I don't know if they started sharing information, medical information, or I just visited all the doctors enough that they knew I was exhibiting drug-seeking behavior, but it became really difficult to get pain medication.
That was probably part about the time when the electronic medical record became more widespread.
It would have been 2016,
right?
17, yeah.
And so, you know, the years leading up to that, we were still, some depending on the hospital or place you worked, they may have still been using a paper chart. But around 2014, 15, it started to become the standard. And that really has changed to where now we can see what all the medications, all the appointments. If, you know, if I have a patient, I can look up and see that, you know, they were in getting stitches at the ER last week or, you know, so that really started to, that was an advancement in technology that really put the kibosh on a lot of doc shopping.
Yeah.
So you had a hard time finding the pain pills and the kind of prescribed medicine.
Yeah. And so I'm recovering from this back surgery and I end up getting a job teaching online high school because I could do that and rest and recover. And I went through a really slow, painful withdrawal. I remember the doctor I was seeing put me on methadone at one point, which was just horrible. I hated that. I know that works for some people. And tried a few other things. I'll say this about those kinds of medications. Buprenorphine probably saved my life more than once. And I know that can be controversial in treatment center work, but I'm an advocate of those kinds of medications. Had it not been for buprenorphine or Suboxone, I would have ended up on heroin, I'm sure. Thankfully, I've had a strong aversion to heroin. I had the opportunity to use it when I was younger in my addiction and somehow understood that if I used heroin, I would die. And I understood that later on too, but I became so dope sick that I actually went out looking for heroin. I couldn't find any. I probably didn't know where to look. And I have a buddy who said I probably gave off a cop vibe. But, if I'd have found it, I probably would have smoked it, injected it. But I'm sure I would have ended up being an IV user and probably ended up dead. So thankfully, I was able to avoid that. But at this point, again, I'm so dope sick and so I'm back at that jumping off place. I can't stand my life. I can't live without drugs and alcohol, and I can't live with it. And I end up back on the floor with my 9mm in my hand, just ready to check out. I think if I could have figured out how to do it without having God know and my children know, I'd have done it. But I couldn't, thankfully. So I don't know. There's some ugly years in there.
I'm going to be honest with you. There's been some ugly years along the way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's what, addicts do. And they go, well, then it got ugly. And now you look back and you go, there were some ugly years, a lot of years.
Yeah, most of those years were pretty ugly.
Well, I think what you're talking about is really interesting psychologically. It's, moments of self-realization. And that's exactly what you're talking about, Casey. We're listening to the story and we're like, it was kind of ugly all along. But you have used very clearly, you were delusional. You were lying to yourself. And so during a lot of those ugly years that other people would have seen, obviously your family knew it was ugly. Your mom knew it was ugly. Your sister knew it was ugly. People are trying to intervene and help you. You're delusional. You're lying to yourself. But then you hit those moments of self-realization and those are just awful but necessary in order to spark change. If you don't get to that, like you call it, jumping off place, if you don't get to that moment of realization of this is an awful existence and you're down in the depths of that despair and that hopelessness, that's necessary because otherwise you just continue on that path of self-destruction and self-deception.
Right.
But Matthew, you talk about being on that floor with your 9mm. And you couldn't live with and you can't live without. And Dr. Matt thinks that this is where your story is going to start to turn around.
No, of course not.
Now, Casey, I've heard enough of these stories. I know there's more.
You can always go. The bottom always gets deeper.
Deeper. That's what people say. How do you get out of a hole? Stop digging. Yeah. But you kept digging.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. The grip that addiction has on people, and I know not everyone that gets addicted to substance is a real addict. Some people can put the plug in the jug and go back to their lives and they're happy and healthy and fine. That's what the big book makes the distinction between an alcoholic and alcoholism. The alcoholism is the underlying spiritual malady or depression or anxiety or inability to be at peace with yourself being sober. And so I find another doctor who is willing to prescribe me the medication I need. At this point, it's primarily opioids. Ugh. I need to mention one thing. I don't like to talk about this part of my story because it's painful. But so the doctor put me on Suboxone first. It was actually the pain clinic I'd been going to. And it's kind of working. I'm on a really high dose of it. I'm supplementing it with weed. And I'm just making it from pill to pill. So I've got it out where I can get right at it when I wake up in the morning. And this would have been, oh gosh, 2000, not long after I lost my job at BYU. My youngest boy would have been about 3 or 4. And I don't know if it still is. The original Suboxone was orange flavored. He gets a hold of a Suboxone pill and ingests it and is overdosing. So my wife and I take him to the hospital, and this is before naloxone or, you know, real understanding of how that medication works. And we're not sure if he's going to make it. And again, to point out the complexity of addiction and how choice is so skewed and limited, and addiction has such a strong grip as a disease, all I can think about while I'm in the hospital with my boy is to get back home to get more of my medication because I've run out. That's where my head is. Of course I love my son. Of course I care about him. Of course I feel bad. But I need that drug to survive. Which reminds me of a really important encounter that I had with, as I'm doing some doctor shopping later on, this would have been 2016, 17. I found this doctor. She was a nurse and a psychiatrist for the Navy. And I thought I could, you know, sweet talk her into giving me some pain meds. And she said something to me that just struck a chord with me that stuck with me ever since. I'm describing, you know, why I need this pain medication. And she looked at me, she said, "That's like the breath of life to you, isn't it?" And it just floored me. I was like, "Well, yes, that's why I need it." And it took me years later to realize that's what addiction does to you. When I'm a big fan of, do you know Kevin McCauley? Dr. McCauley did the movie Pleasure Unwoven and Memoir to Self.
I'm not familiar with him. No.
He's everyone listening to this podcast. Learn about the disease model of addiction. Whether you buy into all that or not, it's really powerful at explaining how addiction works neurologically. Because once you become addicted to whatever your drug of choice is, it overrides all of your other survival needs in your midbrain. To eat, have sex, to survive, fight or flight, whatever else. And also overrides your prefrontal cortex, where all of your good decision-making happens, right? Your reasoning, your morality, your ethics, all of that. The midbrain takes over, and all you can think about is that drug is necessary to my survival right now, right here, right now. That's what I need.
Breath of life.
Right. And that got me thinking about some stuff in a different way about my addiction. Didn't keep me from seeking out and getting the medication. She gave me ketamine to keep me from being suicidal, which I promptly abused, fell into a K-hole. And so I ended up getting hired at my last job I had at East Hollywood High School. And I love that school. I love the people there. I love the students there. But I'm just still on this progressive path of addiction. So I end up at a pain clinic. They're giving me 9 15 milligram OxyContin a day for my pain. That's a lot of pain medication.
Yeah, that's cool.
And also getting me, they know I'm smoking pot, and they're getting me my medical registration cannabis card, which I ended up getting right before, right after I went into inpatient treatment. So I teach at the school. I mean, as horrible as it is to say, I wish I could go back and do those years over. And of course I can't.
You were high while you were teaching.
I mean, I'm on the pain medication. I'm getting high before school, at lunchtime, right after school. So I ended up getting my first DUI two and a half years ago, speeding home from Salt Lake at night. And I think I'm okay because I've been smoking cigarettes. But, of course, my car smelled like pot, and I've got all kinds of pills in the car, and I've got a gun in the car because I'd been camping with my kids. I tell myself that. I think I liked having a gun because, you know, when you're an addict, you get paranoid and never know when you might need a gun. I don't know.
How about never?
Yeah, never would be a good answer for me. So I get taken to the county lockup, spend a week in jail. My siblings come to my rescue, help bail me out, help me with lawyer fees. And, I think they were thinking, this is going to be a good wake up call.
This is his rock bottom.
Right. And my thinking is I've just got to be more careful so I don't get caught.
You're better at it.
Right. Jail teaches us to be better criminals. And that's what I do. I'm more careful for a while. Of course, you know, I end up getting worse and worse. And last May, got my second DUI for not wearing a seatbelt. I got pulled over. And I'm like, what are the odds of that? I'm convinced at this point that if it hadn't been for that, it would have been for something else. Maybe killing somebody in an accident or something. So I'm grateful that that happened now, finally. At the time, I was just pissed. I remember telling the officer, why don't you just shoot me? My life is over. This is going to ruin everything. Because I still had a plan, right? I'm still in charge of everything. I want to be in control of it all. And so because I said, why don't you just shoot me, they put me in a turtle suit in jail. And some of you will know what that is. It's basically like a big moving blanket they wrap you up in so you can't self-harm.
But you were smart enough not to have the gun in the car this time.
No. So if you don't think God has a sense of humor, I get the same exact charge. I had just picked up the gun a few weeks before from the Highway Patrol evidence room where it had been from my previous arrest. So same exact charges, same pills, same pot, everything.
Same gun
in the car.
Groundhog's Day.
It was, I remember thinking the lyrics from the line from a Beck song, I heard heaven today bring its hammer down on me. And I just thought, there you go. That's God telling me something's got to change, right? In hindsight, I think that. At the time, all I'm thinking is, I got to get out of this. So, appropriately enough, my siblings didn't offer up bail money this time. So I spent another week in jail. And a couple of things happen. And I start to see the hand of God in my life. So, you've been in jail.
Yeah.
So, you
know. I only spent one night, but it wasn't good.
No, it's hard to.
I don't like pooping around other people.
No, it's not. Oh, gosh. It's hard to explain that feeling of having your freedom completely taken from you unless you experience it. It's horrible.
Miserable.
But not enough to. Jail and prison aren't going to ever get anybody straight and get them off drugs and alcohol. Anyone out there listening, our penal system doesn't work for that. But I remember going out and looking for some books because I get out 1 hour a day. Found The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is a good read. But I remember this book sticking out of the bookshelf. It was like somebody was handing it to me. And it was this little slim volume. Some evangelical Presbyterian minister had written about the story of Jehoshaphat, which you probably heard the name Jehoshaphat, like jumping Jehoshaphat. I didn't know the whole story. And so I read this book, and Jehoshaphat was the king of Judah, kingdom of Judah. And all these other surrounding armies are coming to battle against his kingdom. And so he sends for his prophet and tells the prophet to pray to God and ask God what they should do, or not what they should do, but to defend his people, basically to destroy the enemies, right? And the answer comes back from God to Jehoshaphat through his prophet that he's going to have to go out and fight the battle. The battle's not his, the battle's God's, but he's going to have to show up in armor and fight the battle. And it gave me just the beginning of an idea of a hope that in fighting the battle of addiction, I'd have to show up and do the work, but God might be there to help me. I mean, I wasn't ready to turn it over yet, but it planted that idea in my head. Of course, I got out and went right back to using what I was using. And I was trying to think of, you know, how am I going to make this work? I had lost my job at my school because I got arrested the week before graduation. So even though we were doing Zoom calls for class, I'm just gone from the scene, you know. And I show up at graduation after I got out and was informed that my contract wasn't going to be renewed. Surprise, surprise. And so I've got no job. I got no home. I'm going to lose my truck and my license. I've got no money. I lost my marriage, my family. My options are limited. One of my favorite AA speakers says, it comes a point where there's no friendly direction. And my options were the street, or I had a few siblings who were willing to help me if I would go into treatment. And that was the condition. And, you know, my addict brain is like, well, I could live in a tent for a while, or, you know, I'm trying to figure out how I can maintain my addiction. And
isn't that weird that treatment is your last resort? You're contemplating how to make the streets seem a little more friendlier. I can get a tent. If I put it here, I can use this bathroom. When the treatment center has a kitchen, has food,
right,
has
a bed,
a heater, a TV, a therapist, and you're like, oh, man.
But there's one problem. It
no
doesn't
drugs.
Have drugs.
Right.
No.
So I've made the decision to go into treatment. At least that's what I tell my siblings. But I'm not sold on the idea. So my place of finding peace has always been out in nature. So I take the dog and go for a hike up Rock Canyon and find my spot where, you know, of course I got drugs stashed there. Really thinking things over for the first time in terms of what my options are and what I'm going to have to do. Got to a point where I mean, I didn't kneel down. It wasn't an official prayer in the way I had been taught to pray. I just knew I needed help, and I just said to whoever was listening, please help me. And those three words probably saved my life. And I felt, again, I had this spiritual experience that just undeniably real. It was like just comfort and love from the universe that let me know that if I was willing to make an effort, things would be okay. And that gave me enough hope to move forward and go into treatment. And for me, those experiences are vitally important, but that's not enough to keep me clean and sober, right? And so I go into Reflections Treatment Center. Can't say enough good about Reflections and the people there. I love them. I wasn't even sure how I was going to pay for it. I know that's a problem with people looking for recovery. And I heard you guys talk about this the other day, but get out there and ask and find some help. There are ways to get into treatment. And I know not everyone needs treatment. I did. I needed a place just to be and to both detox and just reset, at least have a chance to reset. I was lucky enough to have a guy there who worked there and came in at lunchtime and did a big book study. And I really identified with him in terms of his addiction and his recovery. And I started to believe in or be willing to take those 12 steps, even though I didn't really believe I needed them. Didn't believe that they would work necessarily. I mean, I got the first idea of surrender and turn my addiction over to God. And I was willing to do that. And I thought I was good. After a couple of weeks in treatment, I realized getting rid of my addiction doesn't even begin to solve my problems, because my real problem is that underlying spiritual malady. And that's when I made the decision to, in that third step, to turn my life and my will over to God. And I know not everyone works the 12 steps and they don't need them and they're able to recover. They maybe find spirituality another way. For me, it's had to be the 12 steps and working them thoroughly and staying in a spiritual program day to day to day so far. That's what's kept me from relapsing.
And so far, as of today, you're how many months sober?
9 months and a week.
Congratulations.
Thanks, man.
You did 30 days in treatment. You told me off air you did 90 days outpatient treatment.
Yeah.
And you said that you could have used more time.
Yeah. I mean, I think that many, and I don't know, every addict's a little bit different. Our cases of addiction are similar, but our unique stories are different. I think the way that addiction affects us is a little bit different. But drugs and alcohol were so ingrained in my way of thinking and living, I really needed a lot of time just to reset everything. You know, the saying that only one thing needs to change in recovery, and that's everything. But you know, because I knew a lot of really good things. I had learned CBT from the time I was an adolescent, you know. But I needed to, I'm a firm believer that for me, and this is my story and what's worked, addiction for me was, as the big book says, a separation from God and from others and from myself. And my recovery, and really what I was looking for, comes from Carl Jung, that was a base level need to have a union with God, that in using drugs and alcohol, we're really just seeking connection to God. And so for me, that spirituality has been able to take the place of what we call that God-sized hole in my life, in my soul. Having lost my job, I've been looking for a job for a long time. We talked about this.
He's applied for more than 125 jobs in the past, what?
8 months, yeah.
Wow, wow.
But listen to this.
So, and I'm sure some of that was because, you know, I'm overqualified for a lot of them. No one wants to hire a PhD know-it-all.
tell me about it.
some of it may have been ageism, I don't know.
Criminal history?
Criminal history definitely played a part, although I did get rid of the felony, the gun charge, both times, thankfully. So I just have just the misdemeanors.
But listen to this. Raise your hand if you've got a job right now.
Nice.
Our man, Matthew Jackson, has a job. And he just called me last night and says, I got the job.
Congratulations.
So thank you. Yesterday, I found out, well, my PO, my probation officer, was putting the pressure on me. He'd been really patient with me. Understanding it's difficult to find a job in my situation, but it's like, you got to find a job or I'm going to violate you and go back to jail. Again, it's hard for me not to see the hand of God in that. You can call it coincidence. You can call it just fate, whatever. I think I needed that time to work my program and to have some spiritual, psychological, and physical health restored to me, which has happened to some extent. I know there's still a lot of that left to happen, hopefully. But I didn't sleep in inpatient for about 3 weeks. And that last week, I slept about an hour a night. And just in the past couple of months, I've started to sleep more than 3 or 4 hours a night. And I'm sure this new job will get me tired enough that I'll hopefully sleep better. But I listen to your podcasts, other podcasts, AA speaker tapes. I read a ton of addiction recovery material. I read a lot of scriptural, religious writings. And I've spent that time really building a strong foundation for my recovery. And I don't know that I would have made it without that.
I can tell you this, for the 2 years that we've been doing this, Dr. Matt, we've had a lot of people come in and tell their story. I don't think we've had anybody ever go in such detail and be able to tell their story so poetically as you are. And I think you might not see this, but this could be a start of something big for you because you have the information, you have the history, you have the knowledge. And there were so many times during this podcast today that I went, wow. He's mm-hmm. saying what I'm feeling. I mean, even me being close to 3 years in sobriety and you just at 9 months, you've said stuff that hits so home to me and my addiction. I think you are really going to change the game. And not even if that's what you want to, but your story is going to help so many others. I can tell you right now, this is the longest podcast we've ever done. And at no point has I ever thought about checking out. Because
not at all.
I've been along for the ride because it's fascinating. I mean, you've almost had... I mean, starting from your first one was a great story, and this one, and what you've overcome and what you've dealt with, and the sincerity and honesty and the vulnerability that you've shown during this podcast is really going to help so many people. I'm in awe of you, and I'm inspired by you. I think you are an amazing man with an amazing story, and you're just getting started.
That's very nice of you to say. I don't think of myself in that light very, very often.
Dr. Matt, what are your thoughts?
Well, I agree with everything you just said, Casey. I think I was thinking throughout your story that it's because of people who have gone through an addiction and have chosen to share their story and also maybe work in the areas of addiction and recovery that we have progressed in our understanding of addiction. And your story is interesting because it spans that time from almost the dark ages of understanding, you know, addiction and how medications affect us to where we're at today. And I agree with kind of the poetic, highly informed way of sharing that story. So I appreciate you coming on from one Dr. Matt to another. Thank you for coming on and sharing your story. And I hope that I know whoever we reach with this podcast and sharing your story, this will be inspirational for them. But I hope that that teacher part of you, and I relate to that. It's really fun to teach. It's so rewarding to see somebody's light turn on when you teach them a concept and they're a better, different person because of it. And I hope that part of you continues and maybe adds teaching in the field of recovery.
Thank you. That's very nice of you to say. And let me just say a couple of other things. I didn't realize we were going so
long. Oh, the time's great. No, this is
yeah, we're good.
Yeah.
I had been, you know, I mean, you work the 12 steps and you turn your life over and you let go of the need to control and your self-will and pride and yada, yada. And that's a lot of work for someone like me. And in looking for a job, I've very much put that on in God's hands and done the work and done the applications and all of that. And but I had been praying for a job that would help keep me strong in my recovery and allow me to help others. And so I got hired at New Roads Treatment Center in Provo as a psych tech or peer support person. And it's hard for me not to see that as the hand of God in my life, that like I said in the interview, that, you know, maybe this is a way for you to use your teaching skills to help people. And I don't know what will become of that, and I have to live just right here, right now. But I'm very happy about that new opportunity. I want to say a couple other things before we finish that need to be said. I need to thank my ex publicly for holding things together with, God, this is hard. With my kids, not just financially, but really providing a good, safe environment for them and allowing me to be part of that when I've been okay enough to be there. And thankfully, you know, I can be a healthy part of my children's life now. It was only a couple of years ago, one of my daughters, I remember this vividly, and she wasn't the only one of my children who was upset with what was happening. But my daughters are old enough to remember what I was like before my addiction. Sadly enough, my sons have, that's all they've known is dad is an addict. So this is a new dad for them. And he has a lot more boundaries and rules than old dad. Old dad was easy to get along with because, you know, I was checked out. But I remember my daughter saying one night, get out of here. No one wants you here. And that just echoed in my mind forever. And if you don't think that miracles happen in recovery and that relationships are healed and there's some redemption, there is. That daughter and I are now great friends. We stay up late at night watching Cops together, and she's like, did that happen to you? What was that like? Teases me. But that's been, as much as I've felt like, and it's easy as a man without a job, without any money, to feel like a failure in our society. When I focus on my relationships, especially with my kids and my siblings and the new friends that I have, that's just part of the sweetness of life that comes in recovery.
They call that the sweetness of sobriety.
There you go. So, and the last thing I'll say is really put another plug in for everyone learning more about the disease model of addiction. It really helped me. I felt, and we talked about this, the amount of guilt and shame that you feel. And I think particularly in Utah, in Mormon culture, being an addict, that stigma of being an addict that brings such shame and guilt with it, that just perpetuates the addiction. You just need more drugs and alcohol to numb those feelings. That if we could understand that, yeah, addicts make horrible, stupid, selfish choices, and some of that might be more real choice or will in the beginning, but once that addiction takes over, your ability to choose, your will is broken. It's a diseased mind, and we could have a little bit more understanding, even from the professional medical community about that, but certainly in society at large, I think that would be a good step toward helping more addicts and alcoholics get out of their pain.
Wow. thank you. Thank you for stopping by and sharing and being willing to share your story. It's been so informative, so insightful, so inspirational. I think it truly is going to help a lot. And I can't wait to see where this recovery thing takes you, Matthew. I think it's going to be amazing. We want to say thanks, everybody, for stopping by today, listening to this podcast. It's brought to you by our friends at Know Your Script, who Matthew said he wished they would have been around when he first got started. They really do a lot for us. KnowYourScript.org. This is Project Recovery, a KSL podcast.
Contents of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.